Okay, everybody, thank you very much for joining us on this Thursday night for the final section of our initial series on religious Zionism in America. So if you followed us from the beginning, we looked at some of the big personalities who contributed to what I consider the religious Zionist experience in America. And I think one of the big people who we identified from the beginning was the Reverend William Blackstone. Reverend Blackstone taught us that religion and Zionism can go hand in hand, even though he was surrounded by a lot of people throughout the world who understood Zionism as being anything but religious. Remember, we had gotten into this topic because our previous series on the Ukraine highlighted how the Ukraine was the home base of secular Zionism, and also Shmuel Malibur had tried to get involved to sort of synthesize the Zionism with the position of religious Zionism. It wasn't exactly a happy marriage in Europe, but Reverend Blackstone felt very, very strongly about it in the United States and pushed very, very hard for it. And, you know, ironically, he was the one who sort of got the Jewish view and in which was not as in vogue, initially at least. He was the one most responsible for the experience that existed, at least among the secular Jews living in the United States, and the bourgeoisie, the very fancy, wealthy part of the group. In addition, we spent last week looking at a personality who is so fundamental to Zionism in general, but very rarely gets his fair due in the United States, and that was Rameir Bar-Ilan, otherwise known as Rameir Berlin, the son of the Netziv, who has Bar-Ilan University named after him. What people tend to forget is that Rameir Bar-Ilan was a one-man machine, and that was very opposite of what he wanted for the United States, because he had come from Europe where the Mizrahi movement, which he was very heavily involved in, the Mizrahi movement was a movement that he felt to a certain degree, you know, could be brought to the United States, and he felt it was a disaster that it wasn't, and it wasn't being brought forward. And then he had to put, he added into the Zionist picture in the United States, where people were living very much not in the organized structure of Europe, Rameir Bar-Ilan very much had a very different view. And what was the view that he had established for himself? Rameir Bar-Ilan had established a view for himself where the United States, for a person to be in the United States, that person needed to sort of develop a Zionism that was going to be different fundamentally. And so for him to be able to proceed accordingly, Rameir Bar-Ilan wanted very, very much to guarantee that that Zionism would be something that would be understood as part of a bigger Judaism and a bigger understanding. And so when he went ahead and went to move to Eretz Yisrael and then later came back in the time of the Second World War, we saw how he realized how he was going to bring the Zionist issue together with the Holocaust issue and the plight of the Jews to Congress and to make it clear to the government, which was very not interested at that point in time. And so Blackstone was the person most responsible for bringing the Christian religious Zionism to the fore, and along with it, the encouraging of Zionism and fighting anti-Semitism, then I would say Rameir Bar-Ilan was the one who brought it home to religious Jewry and religious Jewry in the United States, and added to it the understanding that a Jew has to be a Jew first, and he has to think about Jews all around the world and create an environment for them. Tonight I'm going to turn to the opposite direction. Instead of looking at how an individual moved forward in order to be able to develop his personal Zionism and spread it forward, we're actually going to look at a person who had to synthesize backwards on the one, and sort of make good for himself and help convey his background and his dreams or his focus, and then ultimately try to put him together and help him help us understand who he was, how he understood the concept of a religious Zionism, which, you know, ironically, if you say religious Zionism in the United States, I don't think you could really mention anybody without mentioning his name. And I refer, of course, to Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, otherwise known in the YU circles as the Rav, or Rav Soloveitchik. You know, if a person would have to ask himself or herself, if Rav Soloveitchik was a Zionist, I think most of us would be left with the understanding that of course he was a Zionist. How could you possibly understand any differently? And a lot of tonight's shiur is going to be based off a series of shiurim and lectures that were given by a great Jewish historian and Rosh Yeshiva historian and student of Rav Soloveitchik. I'm going to quote a lot from Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf. I have a right to do that, not only because I've had the privilege to listen to Rabbi Rakefet through many, many years, but also because we are sitting right here, and before he made Aliyah in the 60s, Rabbi Rakefet was a Rav not too far away from here, right, in Lilburn. And there he was, right in our own backyard. And he was a big admirer of Rav Teitz. And so if he has a perspective, then I think it's important for us to be able to understand it and use it and help us develop an understanding about a religious Zionism of Rav Soloveitchik. I think the first thing we have to understand when we talk about religious Zionism is Soloveitchik's, no matter how you look at them, someone was saying this to me on the other night on our way out of shul. I don't remember who it was, but somebody was talking to me about Briskers in general. And when you say the Brisk school of logic, that is to say the school of Torah thought, they came from the town of Brest Litovsk, or Brisk, as we like to refer to it, whereas in the secular world, Brest Litovsk is a tiny little town with zero significance. In the Torah world, in the modern society, some people actually believe that the Torah was given there, because Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the author of the Beis Halevi, was the Rav there. He had a son, Rav Chaim of Brisk, who was the Rav of Brisk at one point in his life, and he of course wound up in the Valozhin Yeshiva, and then he had a son who was known as the Brisker Rav, Rav Yitzchak Zev or Rav Velvula Soloveitchik. He actually had another son who was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who moved ultimately to the United States and became the senior Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, and that was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, whose sons were Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, both of whom became Rosh Yeshiva and YU. But let's take a step back and start at the Brisker level. If you travel to Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, and you want to go into the Harvard of the Haredi world, you are entering a world known as Brisk. And that Brisker Yeshiva finds itself going back to a dining room table there, where the students and the children of Rav Elvila Soloveitchik set up shop. The way you got into the yeshiva was kind of pretty simple. If there was an empty seat around the dining room table, you got in. If there wasn't, then that was it. The yeshiva was as big as the number of chairs. And some of the great minds of the previous century and our current century, anyone who had the opportunity to learn under the Brisker Rav, under Rav Elvila, many of them became very significant players in the world of Torah. Coming to light, in my mind, of course, is on the one hand, Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Yeshiva Karen Biavne, who founded the Hesder movement. And on the other side, we find Rav Elazar Menachem Shach, for instance, the famous Panovitcher Rosh Yeshiva, who was a very major Talmud of the Brisker Rav. The list would go on and on among the great geniuses that existed, who were all students at one point or another of the Brisker Rav of Rav Elvila. Rav Elvila and Soloveitchik in general had a very, very strong belief in regard to Zionism. It sort of traces itself back to the 19th century, and the Jewish world in general hit a brand new period in life. There was a period where the doors were starting to open throughout Europe, where good chunks of the Torah world was to be found. And in the Torah world over there, there became a period of time where people were leaving the yeshivos for enlightenment. Sometimes the enlightenment crept into the yeshivos. That was one of the issues that might have come up in the Valozhin Yeshiva. And the secularism of this Haskalah, or of this enlightenment, it clashed with some of the basic Torah values of Orthodoxy. And so one of the things that was a sign of Haskalah in the mindset of many, many of the Jewish leaders at that time was the mindset of nationalism that seemed to be very prominent at that point in time. Italians and Germans and Hungarians were all building their own states at that point in time. And so the idea that was being raised was, hey, maybe Jews would be able to go ahead and do so as well. And in addition, as we had pointed out previously, the fact that there was a lot of persecution and anti-Semitism that was going on throughout Europe, and particularly in Russia and Poland, it sort of crystallized the idea of creating a Jewish nationalism. And then there was the famous Dreyfus affair, where Dreyfus was accused of treason against France. And a lot of these things all mixing around at the same time led to a certain founding and a movement where Theodor Herzl stepped forward and began the very first crystallization of an idea that would become known as the establishment of a Jewish state. In the yeshiva world, Herzl appealed to many Jews, but the religious world was very unhappy in general with the practical secularism that he preached. In the initial Zionist Congress, the original Rav had come, and he was chased out by the Russians who were there, who were not interested for the most part. They were intellectual and secular. And so the Zionist movement was deemed to be incompatible. The yeshiva world of Eastern Europe was partially isolated from the influence of the Haskalah, but the ideas were traveling from Western Europe eastward. And of course, as I mentioned to you before, the granddaddy of them all, the Valazhin Yeshiva, was there. And in their Beis Medrash, even before Herzl begins the campaign, in their Beis Medrash, they were already having issues of Zionism. And some of the issues that were coming up in Zionism. And in fact, those of you who may remember, you know, there were Chaim Nachman Bialik, for instance, who was a famous poet, wrote one of his most famous poems, Hamatmid, right? And the poem of Hamatmid was written about a description of somebody in Valazhin Yeshiva. And by the way, that is one of the standard poems that anybody who wants to get out of, say, out of Hebrew or wants to take a matriculation exam to get into college in Israel, you have to kind of study Hamatmid. So yes, I got out of Hebrew in college by studying and taking something called the Yerushalmi exam. And yes, I studied Hamatmid. And there, my dear, my wife, who's listening on the call, just let you know, there's something about me you didn't know. Right? So to be quite honest, you had to study. There was a very strong campaign going on within Valazhin to do what? To also introduce an element of Zionism. Now remember, when all this broke open in Valazhin Yeshiva, there were two Rosh Yeshivas. There was the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the primary Rosh Yeshiva, and he was quite well versed in the Enlightenment and in the Enlightenment literature. And I'll tell you a secret that's not such a secret. This was actually written up by his nephew, by the author of the Torah of Tamima, Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, who describes this in the last volume of his work called Makor Baruch, and he describes the Zionism and the strong feelings that the Netziv felt towards Judaism and to the Zionist element as well. It was once translated by Art Scroll in a work that you cannot find anywhere on Art Scroll shelves anymore, called My Uncle the Netziv. And it caused a major uproar here in the United States when it came out in certain circles. So the Netziv was a passionate supporter of the Zionist movement in theory. And as we discussed last week, it's not a surprise, therefore, that his younger son, Rav Meir Berlin, became Rav Meir Bar Ilan, became the president of Mizrahi in 1902 and was a very close student. And the Netziv's closest student, or one of his closest students, was known as Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who was a very, very strong Zionist. But at the same point in time, the assistant Rosh Yeshiva, the co-Rosh Yeshiva, was Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi. And so, although he left to become the Rav of Slutsk, Rav Chaim stayed on in the yeshiva, and he also became a very dominant personality in the yeshiva. And Rav Chaim was very, very strongly opposed to Zionism. He saw it as godless. He saw the fact that there was going to be no God there, it's going to be secular, which would ultimately take Jews away from true Judaism. It cannot be underscored enough that while it's true that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik
was not a very strong supporter of the Zionist movement, the political movement. If you read through how much ink he spent on issues concerning Zionism, in other words, Kedushat HaAretz, and Tuma and Tara and Kachem and Taros, there is no question that he deeply loved and cared about Kedushat Eretz Yisrael. And by the way, until today, those are the areas that the Brisker Yeshiva is known for studying. You go to and you're studying the yeshivas in the United States. We generally tend to focus in the yeshivas on three main orders of Shas: Moed, Nashim, and Nezikin. And every now and then we introduce Brachos, which is in the section of Zerayim, but not necessarily connected to the land. And we sometimes include a little bit of Meseches Chulin and Kachim as well. But for the overwhelming number of people studying in yeshivos, the rest of Seder Kachim tends not to be covered very well. If you're a student of the Brisker Rav and of Rav Chaim Brisker, you're going to spend a lot of time on those areas, and it's going to become something very valuable and very important. So it's important to see that in Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, we'll call him the Rav from now on, right? In his own background, the Netziv was a great grandfather, and Rav Chaim Brisker was a grandfather. And so as a result, we have strong Zionistic feeling, strong anti-Zionistic feeling coming inside his background. I mentioned to you that Rav Chaim had two sons. The more famous one was Rav Elvela Soloveitchik. He was actually the younger one. He moves to Eretz Yisrael ultimately. And again, his uncomfortable association with Zionism certainly goes back to his father, and possibly his grandfather, and stays prominent today in his family and in his students. But his older brother, who was the father of Rav Soloveitchik of Boston, NYU fame, his father was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He started as the rabbi in Chaslavich, where the population was primarily Lubavitch and religious. And the Russian Revolution changed Jewish life. Communism now started to spread through Russia, and religious life gets decimated. And of course, as you know, communism and religion don't usually go together. And so many of the young people who are living in Chaslavich wind up getting swept up in the euphoria of communism. So what happens is, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik packs his family up, they escape from the communist Russia, and they wind up in Warsaw. Now, Warsaw was also not necessarily a place where you were going to find a tremendous amount of non-Hasidim. Warsaw was the center of the Ger Hasidim. And in that area, and the Hasidic towns that were in Russia and the Ukraine, they find the new founded Aguda movement. Aguda gets founded, Aguda Yisrael, gets founded in 1912, and the intention of finding the Aguda in 1912 was to create this overarching organization that was supposed to go ahead and do what? It was supposed to go ahead and it was supposed to unite Torah Jews against secularism. Now, the conservative element rapidly gets a lot of dominance, and it sort of became known as the overarching organization that opposes Mizrahi and Zionism. And so Aguda becomes known as the traditional European Torah Jewry, and within that environment, that's how the Rav winds up growing up through most of his years. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik needs a job. Yeshivas that are right-wing don't pay that well. And so what happens? He becomes a teacher in a Mizrahi school, which was somewhat enlightened, where secular studies were encouraged along with Jewish studies. It was known as the Tachkamoni school. And the Rav saw in Warsaw that because his father was the modern rabbi teaching in the modern yeshiva, he saw that his father was mocked and he was rejected by his own family, by the greater Soloveitchik family, because he was teaching with the Mizrachinikers, right? The people from Mizrahi. And the Rav saw that even within the school, his father was suffering on the other side, because here he was a Brisker, and he was Torah true, and the rest of the faculty is looking at him, and they're seeing him as modern. And so this pain that a child sees when he sees that his father's unhappy, it sort of affects the Rav sort of seriously. And so, as Rabbi Rekefet likes to say, the Rav's childhood experiences of watching his father suffer plant him with a negative association with Mizrahi. This is how he starts out as a child going into later years. So in 1926, Rav Soloveitchik decides to go to Berlin, and his goal in going to Berlin was to go ahead and to attend the Sorbonne. The Judaism and rabbinic life in Berlin was quite different than the Judaism and rabbinic life in Russia and Poland. In Russia and Poland, you're either Torah or you're secular. And if you're Mizrahi, you're sort of leaning towards secular. In Berlin, he gets a chance to learn about the world of Torah and Derech Eretz, and Rav Hirsch. He gets to go study under Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the famous author of the Sri Deish. He visits Hildesheimer's rabbinical seminary. He sees a bunch of rabbis who have a mature secular education. And he finds out they're also agudas. And he tries to figure out, he says, this is not your father's aguda, right? This was aguda where the people were rabbinir doctors, which they were rabbi doctors with secular education. They were sophisticated, they were educated, they were worldly. And the Rav was kind of amazed by this. And so the 6 years he finds himself in Berlin, he mixes with some of the great Jewish thinkers of the 20th century, and he gets to hang out among the great leaders of the Aguda movement. And the Rav decides, I'm going to become an Aguda leader of this type. I'm going to be entrenched in Torah life, and I'm going to follow this to this path, Torah and tradition, but well-versed in secular philosophy, science, politics, etc. Then the Rav travels to America, and in 1932, he comes to the United States. Why did he come to the United States in 32? Originally, he was brought in by Skokie Yeshiva, the Hebrew Theological College. But it was 1932, which means that we were in the midst of the throes of what period in American history? The Great Depression. And so when the Depression hit the American economy, Chicago, which had brought in this rabbi, was not able to honor the contract. And so the Rav comes in, and he's got to find a place to go live. So he takes a job up in Boston. And a religious life in Boston was not an easygoing sort of place. And so he goes up to Boston, and he develops a challenge, and he also starts looking around and seeing who are the successful rabbis in America. Who was the most successful rabbi in America in 1932? He was in Cincinnati, and his name was Reb Lazer Silver. Reb Lazer Silver is the grandfather of one of my rebbeim in Karen Biavne, Rav Aaron Silver, and of course the great grandfather of my friends Rabbi Yechiel, Rabbi Shalom, and Mr. Aryeh Morris, and of course the great great grandfather of Donny Morris, Zichrono Livracha, whose yahrzeit just passed today. So Reb Lazer Silver was the first American Talmud Chacham. He was a student of Rav Chaim Ozer Grzesinski, who, by the way, Reb Lazer had come to the United States, and he was primarily first involved in the insurance business. Then he became the Rav in a town called Harrisburg, in Pennsylvania, not too far away. In 1937, he decides that he's going to become and lead a delegation to the Aguda Conference, which would be in Europe, which would be the very last Aguda conference in Europe because of what was brewing. Take a look at the year, it was 37. And so what happens? He gets a mandate, go make Aguda in America. So Reb Lazer Silver is responsible primarily for the founding of Agudas Yisrael of America, the very organization that exists today. In the late 30s, when the Aguda refused to support a boycott of Germany and of Hitler, we find in the writings that Rav Soloveitchik, who was also a Rav in Boston at the time, that he agreed with them. And it seems strange if we go backwards. We live in a world where if somebody is not acting properly, we boycott. Just take a look at what we're doing now with Unilever and with Ben and Jerry's and the situation. But we have to remember, in 1930s, the mindset of the people was, don't make trouble. don't confront government authority. And if you went ahead and you created a boycott, made a scene, that would only anger Hitler, and the situation would be made worse for European Jewry. P.S. We find that this system of life also pervaded the discussions about Soviet Jewry. It is commonly understood that there were two groups that were involved in dealing with the Soviet Jews. The SSSJ, or a student struggle for Soviet Jewry, which involved students of Yeshiva University, and they made their scenes, and they protested, and they did all their stuff. And then there was a quiet backdoor. And who was the quiet backdoor who was traveling to Russia constantly, making sure that he could teach Torah? Reb Pinchas Teitz. So for years, and if you talk to some historians who don't check out the storyline, they will tell you that Reb Pinchas Teitz was quite upset with the work of the SSSJ, and he felt that what they were doing was undermining his efforts. It would be in line with the argument of Rav Soloveitchik in the 30s with the Germans. However, if you bother to talk to Rav Teitz Atzal's family, namely, like Avdo Ben Achaim Ben Achaim, Rav Elazar Meir Teitz, our Rav, Shalita, he'll tell you that no. The Rav Pinchas Teitz had to state it in one direction, and on the other side, he felt that because there were extremists that were moving in one direction, that allowed, on the other side, to have people like Rav Pinchas Teitz who they looked away from, and that allowed him to do all the incredible work he was able to do. So, the Rav's Agudas, as far as being an Agudas in the Rav's philosophy, he gave a eulogy in 1940 for Rav Chaim Moshe Grzesinski, and he tried to explain what exactly Aguda philosophy was. And he said, if you think about it, and it's a magnificent essay, according to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, he felt it was one of the Rav's greatest explanations of his philosophy. He says, if you look at the Kohen Gadol, he wore two things that were very unique. He wore a tzitz, a head plate on his head, and he wore a choshen, a breastplate. The tzitz represents the mind. The mind is always committed to halacha, and that's the Kohen Gadol was the supreme theory and the supreme individual involved in halacha. And the Choshen Mishpat represents the worldly issues that people go through, the political questions, the questions of practicality. And of course, again, we ask the Urim V'Tumim, we find throughout Navi, where different Nevi'im and different kings went ahead and checked in with the Urim V'Tumim to see what should be understood. There can be no separation between the two. The mind of Halacha has to also walk with the political, and the political rabbinic control also has to be involved. And so here it is, 1940, the Rav's establishment of Aguda philosophy, he says he understands why Aguda went ahead and established themselves as they did. And Rav Chaim Oz's position, not being in support of Zionism, and the secularizing that Zionism was involved with, Rav Soloveitchik was supportive of, because at that point in time, the secular Zionism was trying to sever the tzitz. It was trying to separate itself from the head and the domination and domain of halacha, and that could not be tolerated. Now, Rav Soloveitchik writes in a work called Chamesh Drashot, which was a series of five talks he gave to the Mizrahi. He found himself having a problem. And here's the problem. Up until 1940, although Dr. Seth Farber, who is a individual, lives in Eretz Yisrael, somewhat of an expert on Rav Soloveitchik's early years, he grew up in Boston, so he anticipates that he feels that it started earlier in the Rav's life, but certainly up until 1940, we seem to find Rav Soloveitchik standing very strongly, squarely in the Agudist camp. Somehow he moves from 1940 to the Mizrahi movement at some point later. And he says, what happened? So the Rav describes this, and he says he was tortured internally. His thesis was that Aguda, which was the Torah community, he called that the thesis. The antithesis, he said, was pain and disaster and the destruction of the Holocaust, and the synthesis whereby he had to somehow do something about the primacy of Torah, but also to deal with the disaster and the pain of the Holocaust, was that some combo in between philosophically was religious Zionism. Now, what came? It was the year 1943. 1943, as we learned last week, was around the time that American Jewry really started to wake up to hear exactly what Hitler was doing in Europe. And when America woke up, the people of Gudde's leadership, who did not allow for a boycott, they said now they're going to go ahead and do something. And so 2 days before Yom HaKippurim, Gudde leaders, including Rav Soloveitchik, marched to Congress to meet with the president. And of course, this was one of the greatest groups assembled at that point in time, the greatest rabbis, 2 days before the busiest day of the year for rabbis, arguably. And they all came in from all over the country to march on Washington. And they marched all the way up to the White House, and they knocked on the door. And did the president meet with them? No, he refused. He sent out Henry Wallace, about whom we learned last week. He denied the whole storyline. And they went home defeated and dejected. And when it became known that 6 million plus Jews had been murdered, it caused them a tremendous amount of mental anguish. And it caused the Rav to make a reevaluation of his own philosophy. And he came to the decision that he had been wrong, that he had been wrong about the primacy of rabbinic edict, of what we call Das Torah in the realm of Hashkafa, and that he had been wrong in the relevance of Jewish activism. And so he when he speaks in Chamesh Drashot, he says that in the realm of Halacha, there's no question. We have rules, and it's the rabbinic authority that has to decide. So issues like Gerus, issues like Kashrus, that continue to be very big issues in the world today, and certainly in the Israeli society today, these things don't belong being decided in the Knesset. And it's a disaster when they do. There was a news story that came out, I think I referenced it this week, that they're now going to be providing IVF coverage for Agunot. That is to say, women who are not divorced can get IVF done. And between you, me, and not the lamppost, it's a terrible, terrible thing. Women are going to be able to have mamzerim. Literally. It's a disaster that's ready to happen. And it's a horrible situation, and it's coming out because the rabbinic authorities have been pushed to the side. Well, for Rav Soloveitchik, he felt, as far as halacha is concerned, God gave Torah to man, and our capacity for halacha creativity must first begin with the understanding of where it belongs in the rabbinic realm. But he said for issues in Hashkafa that are outside the Dalet Chelkei Shulchan Aruch, the focus is not on man's insight. We have to always be evaluating what God wants from us. And he says there's nothing that's infallible, and there's no one Rebbe who is exempt from the obligation to constantly go over what his Hashgafa is. And so, according to Rav Soloveitchik, this is very similar to what Yosef and his brothers had to go through. The children of Yaakov knew that there was going to be a galus because they were descendants of Avraham Avinu. But Yosef wanted to question the comfortable life of the family and get them to think and rethink the status quo that they were living in, according to Rav Soloveitchik. And the brothers didn't agree. And they said, Yosef, you're guilty of treason for even suggesting it. Stay in Canaan. It's comfortable. It's settled. It's secure. Now, what happened in the end? Who was right? Was Yosef right, or are they right? It seems that Yosef was right. It seems that Yosef's dreams came true. And so the Rav explained that the Mizrahi in 1902 were like Yosef HaTzadik. They wanted to mix things up. And the Aguda of 1902 or 1912 was the exact opposite. And they were comfortable with status quo. And Mizrahi dreamed, and Aguda didn't. And without Mizrahi, there would have been no place for refugees to go after the war. Without the Yishuv, Hitler would have killed out Judaism. And the Rav said this is completely due to the Mizrahi ideology. And then he says there's an idea that Jews have to take a stand. And that Jews have a responsibility not to be just people who who are people of books, they also have to be people of deeds. And he said that this is the tradition that we have. And when we think of risk, he says, it's really the intellectual creativity of a person emulating God through the study of Torah. But that creative power also has to be outside, in the outside world. And so the Rav says, let's take a look. When it comes to the brachos in Parshas Toldos, right? What does Rivka do? Rivka tries to make sure that Yitzchak gives the brachos to Yaakov. Not just the bracha of Talmud Torah, but the bracha of running the world as well. And so according to Yitzchak, you know, the job of a person who is committed to Torah is to be Yoshev Oalim. Let somebody else be in charge of activism and running the world. Rivka says no. Yaakov, she told Yaakov to go to the fields and to fight for the bracha of Shamayim and Aretz, get a foothold in the outside world. That's the only way that the Torah world can survive. And so the Rav said that the vision of Mizrahi was actually that as well. Mizrahi was not just interested in what? In people who would sit and learn full-time. Remember what we learned about Rav Meir Bar Ilan last week? He was not opposed to people learning. And he supported the yeshivas. Not only the Hesder yeshivos. But he turned around and he also supported people who were going to be farmers. And he wanted them to also understand that they're not a second-class Torah citizen. With the true achievement of the State of Israel was the creation of a people with a Gemara in one hand and a plowshare in the other. And this activism was at the heart of the Zionism of Rav Soloveitchik and the focus of his entire worldview. And so we find that Rav Soloveitchik contends with this tremendous tension that he has in his life between being true to his family and yet at the same time looking at world events. And what he does is he actually says, my parents and my grandparents were exactly like me. They innovated. They were active. The Reb Chaim's brisk was not just a place where he sat in the yeshiva all day long. Quite the opposite. He said that he turned around and he focused. And that led to a certain perspective, which the Rav certainly highlights in an essay that became part of required reading for all Israeli high school students. It's called Kol Dodi Dofek. The voice of my beloved is knocking. And in 1956, this was actually a speech that Rav Soloveitchik had given to the Yeshiva University. It was based on a comment in Shir HaShirim. And it's the beloved is home and she's already gotten changed and she hears her beloved knocking at the door and she says she tarries before she gets out of bed to unlock the door. The Rav says each of us is given a chance to reach for something, to become great and to actualize our potential. And from Shir HaShirim, we have to make sure that our apathy and our feelings or inadequacy and laziness doesn't make us spoil the opportunity. And so he identifies six knocks that call to wake us up for greatness. He says the first knock was political. That's when the United States and the Russians decided to vote that there should be a Jewish nation. That should never have happened. If the United States said it was daytime outside, the Russians would have said it was nighttime. The second was military. Here it was 1956. Take a look. In 48, the tiny Jewish forces, the ones that Dr. Wenger's father, Zichrono Livracha, you know, fought in, leaving on the night of his wedding to go fight in that battle. And so many like him, in tiny, tiny groups, that the victory of those tiny forces handicapped also by the fact that nobody would sell arms to this small nation. And they were terribly outnumbered, and yet they were successful. And Am Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael was Chayav HaKayim. The third was theological. The Christian doctrine was now upside down because the Jewish people became a vibrant player on the world stage, and that was very much the opposite of what the Christians believed. The fourth knock that the Rav described was sociological. He said the fact that Jews from all around the world felt proud to be Jewish and were reassociating themselves with Jewish identity was a key issue. and was something else that we have to wake ourselves up to. The fifth was an international change of attitude that happened because there was a state of Israel. The fact that Jews had a position of power and a homeland meant that you couldn't spill Jewish blood just anywhere. You know, when Jews go ahead to go to far-flung places, Uman, you know, when up until recently, if a Jew went to Uman for Rosh Hashanah, he knew that somewhere in the background there would be safety. Do you know why? Because the Israeli government had sent protective services and forces to make sure that that area of the Ukraine was safe for all those people who had come. And countless times, it was the Israeli government that went ahead to deal with their people, even if they weren't directly Israeli citizens. In 1976, this would come into play when there was the famous episode in Entebbe. But of course, the Rav couldn't have known about that when he was speaking 20 years earlier. The sixth and the final knack that he described was the fact that there were Jews coming from all over the world, and they were all being Olim. If I may, it is suggested that this was perhaps the biggest description of the religious Zionist thought of Rav Soloveitchik and American religious Zionism. An American religious Zionist has to wake up and be active. An American religious Zionist has to see what happens. An American religious Zionist has to have a sense about him. But at the same time, Rav Soloveitchik Zionism doesn't match up with the prevailing Zionism in Israel at the time. Today, if you talk about Sioni or Dati Leumi communities, the first name that you hear is not Rav Soloveitchik's. Whose name and whose philosophy? Arav Kook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. What's the difference between the philosophy of Rav Soloveitchik and that of Rav Kook? Both of them agree that Zionism is connected to Torah. But according to Rav Kook, the Zionism is a reflection of his Torah perspective. For the Rav, his Zionism came after a tumult and a struggle. Rav Kook said it was just natural. There's Yishev HaAretz, that's a mitzvah. There's Kashrus, that's a mitzvah. It's a straightforward process. It's much more exalted. When it comes to Rav Soloveitchik, his Zionism comes after a struggle. He doesn't give Zionism an independent mandate in religious life. He sees it within certain other contexts. And so, that would lead to one major split that became very common among the two different Zionist schools of thought. To an Israeli Dati Leumi person, Yishuv Haaretz takes primacy over so many other mitzvot. To a student of Rav Soloveitchik, it is but one of many mitzvos, which may explain something very, very fundamental, which is, when you think about Rav Kook, where does he wind up living? In Eretz Yisrael. Where does Rav Soloveitchik wind up living and the rest of his life? In Chutz La'aretz. We asked Rav Schachter on a number of occasions, and I think he just recently gave the same answer again, as to why. Why did Rav Soloveitchik, if he was such an ardent religious Zionist, why is it that he never made Aliyah? And he had the chance on more than one occasion. And the answer that he gave was, at one particular point in time he felt that it was very important that a Rav or a Rebbe be around for his Talmidim and his congregants. And he felt that unless somebody of parallel caliber were to be there to do a better job, then he wouldn't be allowed to leave within the process, because he can't leave his community. How could you do that? What's going to happen to the people you're leaving behind? And so he encouraged his Talmidim before they made Aliyah. He says, it's great what you're doing for yourselves, but what are you doing to make sure that the communities that you build are able to stay long after you're gone? I think that's a very important idea within a religious Zionist American framework. It's very different from a religious Zionist framework of Rav Kook or his Talmidim, who continue until today. It's not as militant, and it's always put within a bigger context, as opposed to it being as strong a straightforward mitzvah as any of the others. I think when we reevaluate the Zionism of Rav Soloveitchik, the Zionism of Rav Meir Bar Ilan, and yes, Lahavdil, the understanding of what Zionism should be in the mindset of Reverend Blackstone, I think what we come out with is an awareness first of the American mindset. It's the goal of harnessing the great power of the person to be able to go ahead and infuse him with a sense of religious responsibility. And in the cases of Rav Meir Bar Ilan and Rav Soloveitchik, to make sure that no matter where a Jew is anywhere in the world, every one of his thoughts are always focused v'sechazeno hinenu b'shuvcha l'tzion b'rachamim. And may HaKadosh Baruch Hu give us the opportunity to experience that experience, and the experience that comes with it, where v'einenu sirena malchusecha kadavar ha'amur b'shirei uzecha ayidei David Mashiach tzedkecha. May we get the chance to see that speedily in our day, and all of us together. I thank you very much for joining us for the series, and wish you all a Shabbat Shalom.